This week on The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
The push to have bigger families and more babies is part of a movement called pronatalism. They are freaking out about declining global fertility rates. And that is real. It's a phenomenon called birth dearth. What's behind this push to start a new baby boom? Who are the voices pushing for a more pro-family America? And what exactly does that mean?
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, streaming now on your favorite podcast app.
In Kenya, thousands of people took to streets across the country to protest their government.
What happens in the streets is really just a manifestation of anger.
Anger over police brutality and the rising cost of living. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also today, assessing the damage done to Iran's nuclear program. Western intelligence is listening in to conversations between Iranian officials. But is what they're saying actually reliable?
You know, there may be a great tendency for people to underreport or overreport the actual damage.
And for tonight's NBA draft, one of the top prospects started getting attention several years ago as a teenager in the Africa League.
I remember thinking to myself, this kid is not like the others.
We've got all those stories for you and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us. We begin in Kenya, where thousands of people took to the streets today to show their frustration with the government.
We must fight for Kenya. We are here to fight for our country. We have suffered a lot. There is no job.
Today's protests mark the one-year anniversary of anti-tax demonstrations that turned deadly. At least 65 people were killed and 89 others went missing, according to Amnesty International. News reports say several people were killed in today's demonstrations. And this all comes on the heels of protests last week in Kenya against police brutality. Owino Okech says that's just one thing driving these protests. She's a professor at the University of London and says she is not surprised by the police action.
It was not unexpected. I think Kenyan police have often acted overly ambitiously and with a lot of force to protesters, even when they're peaceful. So unfortunately, I'm not surprised.
And so that is what you are seeing today.
Exactly.
So as you mentioned, these protests are marking the anniversary of demonstrations held in Nairobi 1 year ago today that saw protesters storming parliament. Some 60 people were killed. That was about taxes, right? That's what kicked off those protests?
Yes, the protests were kicked off around the finance bill that was being proposed to deal with the large, you know, debt infrastructure, deal with cost of living questions in the country. And it proposed very high taxation. I must note that what initially began as a conversation about taxation and protests around the finance bill quickly escalated to a conversation about governance writ large and slowly evolved into a challenging whether the current president should stay in office and whether he was actually delivering for the people.
And so the current president, William Ruto, is still in office. Did the protesters get anything else that they were calling for? Did those demonstrations bring about results?
Well, I think President Ruto is a good tactician. So he did a number of things that made it seem like the protesters were gaining ground. So, for instance, he dissolved the cabinet. He made a decision to halt the signing, assenting the bill into law after June 25th.
The finance bill?
The finance bill. Made some moves around talking to young people. So all of, there were some visible things that he did that seemed to indicate that he was interested in listening and interested in shifting. However, we have now discovered that in December 2024, the finance bill came into force with all of the provisions that people were pushing against in force. And the next finance bill is actually going to be worse.
Mm. So was today really a continuation of that other protest movement? I mean, are they still calling for the same things?
The call really is around whether Ruto should stay in office and whether we need a different governance arrangement. Now, obviously, we know for those of us who study social movements and protests that what happens in the streets is really just a manifestation of anger. It's a manifestation of particular sets of feelings amongst a category of people. The larger work around whether Ruto will stay in office or not is not going to happen in the streets alone. It will require other forms of organization to ensure that works, whether that happens by waiting for the next election and mobilizing the right form of candidates to get into office is a question that I think every Kenyan and active citizen is debating and thinking about.
Mm. You mentioned this represents what a particular group of people is thinking and feeling. These protests were driven by young people. They've been called the Gen Z protests. How much political power do they have off of the streets? And do you think that this movement will translate into additional political power?
Well, they have voting power. Many of the young people who are on the streets today are going to be voting for the first time in the next election. So if we're thinking numbers, purely numbers, from a numbers perspective, they matter for regular election processes. Secondly, I think the conversation about the protest and the mood in the country has radically moved from Gen Z. So while I think it is the young people who are active on the streets who are very clear about what they will and will not tolerate, the mood in the country is not just reflective of Gen Z. I think there's a general consensus, obviously aside from those who are supportive of President Ruto, that things must change.
Mm. We were talking on the program last week about another big protest movement in Nairobi, demonstrations against police violence after a blogger died in police custody. Is that cause kind of being merged with this one today? Is that another reason people are taking to the streets today?
Since June 25th, 2024, there have been conversations around extrajudicial killings. There have been conversations around enforced disappearances. So indeed, while the murder of Albert Ojwang in police custody is absolutely terrible, unfortunately, he forms one amongst many other people who have died in the hands of police, in custody or outside. Unfortunately, again, this is part of a much longer history about our police service. And even though there have been regular conversations about police reforms, we have an independent police oversight authority that was supposed to strengthen accountability around policing, there is still a lot more work to be done in relation to effective policing in the country.
You mentioned that police and the government were prepared for today's protests. What are they saying about them today?
Well, the government has spoken through a number of actions. So, for instance, it has ordered all the national television stations to stop broadcasting the live protests, which they have ordinarily done over the years, simply to keep people abreast with what is happening. So that's a silent move that they have made. The police are all over the country, not just in Nairobi, but everywhere else, and are already lobbing tear gas. Earlier, two people are dead, several hundred, at least 300 earlier on, I believe, were reported to be injured and were being treated, you know, in the city center. So that is how they are speaking. There hasn't been a formal statement from the government.
Where do you see this ending? Does this all culminate in the election?
It may culminate in the elections. It may culminate soon. I think Kenya is on a bit of a precipice. I think that either we listen to each other and have a conversation about the social contract. Unfortunately, those who sit in power, and there have been several conversations on national television stations and radios across the country about a deep fear that we might be returning to the era of Daniel Arap Moi, which is a very difficult era of over 23 years of autocratic government. And that is not what we want to see as a country. And so one can do two things. Hope that President Ruto has the right set of advisors that ensures that he does not use state power in the raw form that he's using at the current moment. Or, on the other hand, continued protests and other forms of mobilizations continue as it prepares the pathway for the next general elections and using the ballot box as that opportunity. But who knows? We might have another Egypt or Tunisia on our hands. Who can tell?
Owino Okeich is a professor at the University of London.
Scorching heat and humidity are stifling a lot of the U.S. right now. Places where there are fewer trees and more asphalt help create urban heat islands. The hot air feels oppressive, but India offers an example for how to deal with those overheated city conditions. Reporter Sushmita Pathak traveled to Ahmedabad in western India in the midst of last summer's swelter to learn more about efforts to deal with extreme heat.
The houses in Ignas Park in the old part of Ahmedabad don't have air conditioning. It's a low-income neighborhood and the houses are built close to each other, so there's little natural ventilation. To make matters worse, many of them have tin sheet roofs that heat up during the summer. It gets so hot that being indoors becomes unbearable, says resident Sushma Mishra. Mishra works out of her home, attaching tiny, sparkly rhinestones on dresses. It's hard work that requires concentration, and heat makes it worse. I have to wipe sweat from my face with one hand and work with the other, she says. Mishra decided to do something about the heat. She climbed up on her roof and painted it with a special bright white paint. The paint reflects the sun's radiation and keeps homes cooler, says Bhavna Mahiria.
There is a different chemical. It's called titanium dioxide and acrylic. This material they use to make this solar reflective white paint.
Mahiria is with Mahila Housing Trust, a non-profit that works on climate change adaptation. It has been providing solar reflective paint to low-income families at subsidized rates.
The temperature reduction is minimum 4 to maximum 7 to 8 degrees Celsius.
Jewarbhen Thakur, who also used the paint, says she could feel the difference within a day. Earlier, my feet would burn when I stepped on the roof. But now I can easily walk barefoot, she says. A few houses away, a man is sweeping another roof before starting to paint. More than 15,000 homes in Ahmedabad have been painted so far, Mahiria says. It's one of the many steps the city has taken to adapt to extreme heat. The turning point for the city came in 2010, says public health researcher Abhiyan Tiwari.
Back in 2010, there was a devastating spell of extreme heat event, above 46 degrees Celsius maximum temperature, and also minimum temperature was also very high. And the city reported, increase in the average daily mortality.
People die of heat every year in Ahmedabad, but that season, the death toll was higher than usual. 1,300 more people died. It jolted authorities into action, and in 2013, Ahmedabad became the first city in South Asia to launch a heat action plan.
The city was committed to work on it. The city recognized it.
Tiwari, who is now with the Natural Resources Defense Council India, helped draw up the heat action plan. It includes early warnings of extreme heat, training doctors and nurses to respond to heat-related illnesses, and promoting adaptation measures like roof painting and planting more trees on roads. Another key element, Tiwari says, is raising awareness about the dangers of heat. People in tropical countries like India are used to heat and often don't take it seriously, he says.
We need to understand that the body has a limit to tolerate heat.
A 2018 study showed that the heat action plan helped Ahmedabad avoid 1,190 additional deaths per year. Ahmedabad's success has inspired cities in 23 other states. But just making a heat action plan is not enough, says Mahiria, the researcher from Mahila Housing Trust.
We know maximum cities, they have developed their heat action plan, but there is no implementation.
Implementation is what other cities can learn from Ahmedabad, she says. Climate change adaptation measures often focus on health, and rightly so. But the effects of extreme heat go beyond health. Daily wage earners who work outdoors lose income when it's too hot to work.
Their work efficiency decreases, out-of-pocket medical expenditure increases, and the energy demands increase. So their electricity bills increase and they have to pay more.
Dr. Rajvi Joshipura works at the trade union SEWA, or Self-Employed Women's Association, which represents women workers in India's informal sector. To help its members make up for lost wages, SEWA rolled out a special heat insurance this year. It was a parametric insurance. Payout is triggered automatically when certain parameters like temperature are crossed.
Interventions like parametric insurance, they provide members with immediate relief. Whereas in case of an indemnity insurance, there is a surveyor who will come to your place, analyze stuff, analyze loss, and it's a long process.
50,000 women across India received amounts ranging from $5 to $20. Kokila Ben Makwana is a grassroots SEWA leader from a village just outside Ahmedabad. She works directly with the workers who received the money. Women were overjoyed when they got messages on their phone that the money had been deposited, she says. They used the insurance payout to buy groceries, to buy seeds and water for farming, she says. Mahiria from the non-profit Mahila Housing Trust says parametric insurance can be a useful climate adaptation tool. Her organization also runs a heat insurance program. But climate extremes go beyond heat, and Mahiria and her team are now looking into expanding the insurance to cover excess rain too. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak, Ahmedabad.
NATO leaders held a summit today in The Hague, where European allies were focused on President Trump and what he was messaging. But one detail that the Kyiv Post is reporting on concerns what the president of Ukraine was wearing. It was a suit. Volodymyr Zelensky was in all black, jacket, shirt, dress pants, no tie, a stylistic departure from the military-style clothing he's worn since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine more than 3 years ago. On Zelensky's feet, though, black combat boots. The substance of Zelensky's meeting with Trump, we'll lace that up later on today's show.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor here at The World. While I may not be a familiar voice, I've been deeply committed to our work here at The World for years, helping to share the exceptional global journalism you know and love. Since our launch in 1996, The World has weathered many storms, and we remain committed to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. But we are in unprecedented times, and never has the threat to public media been greater than right now because of the efforts to withdraw all federal funding. This puts greater pressure on our newsroom and our journalists. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We're powered by listeners like you. And right now, we need your help. Even if you've never given before, perhaps today is the day. We are in our spring fundraising drive, and a generous donor has offered a 2-to-1 match, tripling your impact between now and June 30th. That means if you donate $25, we receive $75. Your $100 equals to another $300. If you've given in the past, please consider renewing your gift or increasing your monthly contribution, if only by a small amount. Every gift, no matter how small, truly makes a difference. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Satellite images of the Iranian nuclear facility beneath a mountain at Fordo now shows neat clusters of small black holes in the ground. Fordo is one of the places where the U.S. military dropped enormous bunker buster bombs, but the images alone cannot explain what damage was done to the Iranian nuclear program. The U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency has an early assessment that was leaked of the damage. It says Iran's nuclear program was only set back by several months. Meanwhile, Israeli news reports claim that it was set back by years, and President Trump quickly used the word obliterated to describe what happened. Jeffrey Lewis knows what goes into these sorts of intelligence assessments and what's needed to investigate the status of the Iranian nuclear program. He's with the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey.
I think the estimates can often mean different things. It may be the difference between how long it would have taken Iran to build a bomb before, if they had chosen to do so, versus now. It could also mean how long it will take Iran to get back to where it was before the bombing. So I think, in addition to some of the uncertainty about what kind of damage occurred, there's also a lot of ambiguity when people talk about what it means for the program to be set back.
Yeah, and that ambiguity should remind us that any assessment by Iran, the U.S., or Israel on what nuclear material infrastructure was damaged will have some political bent to it. That said, multiple actors will be trying to determine what happened. We know satellite images are helpful, but they only go so far. What other methods are intelligence agencies using to figure out what happened?
Well, I think satellite images are pretty important because those are relatively objective. You know, seeing is, in at least some sense, believing. And those satellite images are not going to just be pictures like you and I are used to looking at, but they'll also be images taken with things like radar, which can really tell, for example, if an underground facility has collapsed and maybe the mountain has sunk a little bit. I think we've seen in press reporting, there's also a lot of attention paid to signals intelligence. So picking up conversations between Iranian officials talking about what had happened. But one of the challenges that arises there is, are the Iranians even telling the truth to one another? You know, there may be a great tendency for people to underreport or overreport the actual damage.
Given that the underground nuclear research and development was deep under many meters of rock, I mean, what can satellite imagery reveal about that?
You know, you're not really going to get a lot of information. What I think the U.S. government is going to have is a model of the facility, some idea of how strong it is, and they're going to look for evidence that they were able to hit what they were aiming for, assuming that their model is correct. But, you know, you might imagine that if the facility were to collapse, you might see some change in the elevation of the overall mountain. Or if the facility had collapsed, you might have seen dirt or soil blown out of the tunnels. Right now, we don't see any of that, and that probably accounts for why the Defense Intelligence Agency thinks that even if the facility was severely damaged, it probably didn't collapse.
So as for signal intelligence, I mean, talk about that. How are intercepts intercepted between people talking about what's happening?
Well, there are a variety of technical means. There are some satellites in space that pick things up, and then there are also terrestrial ways of doing it. You know, really any signal that's broadcast is intended to be received, and so the trick is just putting yourself between point A and point B. Usually those kinds of conversations should be encrypted, and there may also be the ability to, if you can't necessarily understand a conversation, you might be able to look at the pattern of the conversation and figure out what's going on. So you may not know what people are talking about, but if you're making a lot of calls to the kind of people who fix things, well, that might tell you something about what's going on.
Do you have an example of information, intel, that's been picked up over the years through this kind of data gathering?
Very recently, we saw that there was a significant increase in alarm in the United States during the war in Ukraine because there was what was typically referred to as chatter among leading Russian military officials about the prospect that Russia might use a nuclear weapon. And so that's a case where you both get an alarm because people are talking on an open line and you can pick up and interpret what they're saying. But then also you might notice that they might be talking to one another, but if nobody is talking to the units that would actually do it, then you know they're just complaining rather than actually planning.
So how important are human sources to answering these questions?
If the Iranians go inside or make their own damage assessment, and by the way, they may not at this point fully understand how damaged the facility is because the entrances were sealed. But once someone gets inside, that person is going to have firsthand knowledge. So getting that person to betray their country and tell you what's going on, or just simply eavesdropping on their phone calls, that can be incredibly valuable.
And do you think there are going to be some non-Iranian investigators who will be given access?
Well, the big question is whether Iran is going to let the International Atomic Energy Agency back in. What we have now seen is that the Iranian parliament has passed a bill suspending cooperation with the IAEA. So I think it would be best for the world and best for Iran if they let the IAEA back in. But right now, it looks like they're resisting that.
What about this whole current murkiness about Iran's nuclear program, Jeffrey? Do you find most interesting?
There is an enormous amount of attention paid to a small number of high-profile facilities.
Hmm.
But the Iranian nuclear program is much bigger than that. There are many other underground facilities in Iran, some of which we know are involved with the nuclear program, some of which we suspect are involved with the nuclear program, and none of which were struck. So it's very interesting to me to watch the almost laser-like focus on a small number of facilities that people know about without really looking at the program as a whole in a much more comprehensive way.
Jeffrey Lewis is a professor at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California.
You may remember this from not too long ago during a Toronto Raptors game when the American national anthem was played.
Yeah, that kind of tarnished the stereotype of Canadians always being nice. So now, as we approach Canada Day on July 1st and the 4th of July right after that, Canada is taking the high road.
This summer, your kids can explore Canada's national galleries and museums all summer long for free.
That's Canada's new premier, Mark Carney. And what he's trying to express here is that he likes us, Americans. He really likes us.
Canada has everything. Canada's ready. When you are.
Not to be outdone, Canada's Eastern Townships in southeastern Quebec has produced an ad highlighting its brand of Canada nice.
Bonjour, est-ce que je peux vous aider?
Sorry, I don't speak French. I'm just visiting.
Well, then
things look like they might get ugly given the supposed animosity between our two countries.
Where are you visiting from?
I'm American.
Ah, okay.
And then the woman hits a button under the reception desk. The kind a bank teller might use to quietly alert the cops during a robbery.
But then she comes out from around the desk and gives the American a big hug. Gotta love Canada.
They really are so nice.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. NATO members have agreed to ramp up their military spending to equal 5% of their gross domestic product, or GDP. This will be seen as a major win for President Trump. The U.S. has long accused European nations of not pulling their weight on defense. But some NATO leaders are less enthusiastic than others about this decision. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has been following today's event. Hey there, Orla.
Hi, Carolyn.
Okay, so President Trump has been pushing NATO members to increase their defense spending for years since his first term in office. How much of today's move was driven by that and how much of it by the threat posed by Russia?
I guess the truth is both. Both played a significant role. You had French President Emmanuel Macron saying today it came as a direct response to the threat from Russia. You had the Lithuanian president this morning on the sidelines of the summit saying this wouldn't have happened without President Trump. Mark Rutte, who's the Secretary General of NATO now, he said, given this threat from the Russians, given the international security situation, there is no alternative. But he also acknowledged that it was Trump who really forced their hands on it. And in fact, there's been a lot of kind of questions and criticisms of Mark Rutte over the past 24 hours about how much he seems to be, as some journalists have been putting it, sort of fawning to President Trump. One journalist asked him this morning, is this the only way to do business with the US president now, with flattery and with praise? And is it all a little bit demeaning that you have to behave like this?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a bit of a question of taste, but I think he's a good friend. I mean, would you ever think that this would be the result of this summit if he would not have been re-elected president? Do you really think that the 7 or 8 countries who said, yeah, somewhere in the 2030s we might meet the 2%, we've now all decided in the last 4 or 5 months to get to 2%? So doesn't he deserve some praise?
President Trump, as you probably can imagine, did claim credit for this in his own press conference this afternoon. He called it a monumental win for the U.S.
So President Trump and Mark Rutte are very enthusiastic about this, but not every country is, right? I know that Spain, for example, was spending well below its previous target of 2% of GDP on defense. So how are they reacting today?
You're right. And I mean, to put it in perspective, we are talking about hundreds of billions of dollars here. So we're asking countries to significantly ramp up the amount of money they spend on their defense. Spain spent only 1.2% of its GDP on defense last year, didn't even reach anywhere near the 2% target. And just a few days ago, Pedro Sanchez, the prime minister, Spanish prime minister, had been saying they were looking to opt out of this agreement to reach the 5% target. Now, they didn't quite do that today. They did join in with the other NATO member states and said, you know, they pledged to reach this target at some point. But then he gave his own press conference this afternoon and sort of gave a bit of a woolly response. And so the language, as I heard somebody putting it a little bit earlier in the declaration itself, is all a bit mushy. It's kind of mushy diplomacy, and it does allow for wiggle room from various member states. The most criticism, however, about Pedro Sanchez came this afternoon when President Trump was asked what his reaction was to Spain's position.
You know what we're going to do? We're negotiating with Spain on a trade deal. We're going to make them pay twice as much. And I'm actually serious about that. We're going to make Spain. I like Spain. I have so many people from Spain that it's in a great place and they're great people. But Spain is the only country out of all of the countries that refuses to pay.
President Trump also met with Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, on the sidelines of today's summit. Do we know anything about how that meeting went or if there were any outcomes?
Well, he said it was a very good meeting with President Zelensky. He said it was a very different tone from what we witnessed in the Oval Office back in February. He said Zelensky is fighting a very brave battle. He said we've had some rough times, referring to himself and the Ukrainian leader. But he said Zelensky couldn't have been nicer. He was asked, there was quite a moving exchange between himself and Ukrainian journalist who asked him if America would consider sending more Patriot missiles to Ukraine. And he asked her a little bit about herself. And she said her own husband is a soldier who's fighting there now. And he said, you know, I wish you a lot of luck. I can see this is very upsetting for you. Say hello to your husband. And he said he would see if we can make some of those Patriot missiles available. You know, nothing nothing was committed to. Vladimir Zelensky, on his part, also tweeted a very short time ago that he had had a good meeting with President Trump in The Hague and that Ukraine is ready to buy this equipment that's needed and support American weapons manufacturers. I mean, one thing that should be said, that the last time at the last NATO summit when Joe Biden was in office, there was references, very strong references to Russia's culpability in invading Ukraine 3 years ago. All of those references were missing today. And this has sort of been seen as a concession to keep President Trump on side.
Mm. Another key moment at today's summit in The Hague was President Trump confirming his commitment to Article 5 of the NATO treaty. That is the one that guarantees members will come to the defense of other members if they come under attack. Was that seen as a significant today?
I mean, I think in terms of putting fellow NATO members' minds at ease, pretty significant. Whether President Trump will stand by that position is another question. I mean, you're right, this Article 5 is one of the cornerstones of the Mutual Defence Pact, this idea that an attack on one member is an attack on all. He was asked about it on his way to the summit. And at the time, the response that he gave was that there are numerous definitions to this principle. So it was seen as quite a non-committal answer to it. He had a very different take on it today. He said, I stand with Article 5. That's why I'm here. This evening, a lot of the various NATO leaders coming out of the summit called it a historic summit. And they also felt that the US was back on board with NATO again. I mean, that wasn't always the sentiment, but certainly it feels a little bit different today. And President Trump said, we had a great victory here today. And for Mark Rutte, that'll be seen as a big success.
A lot of news coming out of NATO today. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Berry, thank you so much for bringing it to us.
Thank you, Carlin.
And now let's catch you up on a few other global headlines.
India, Poland, and Hungary all have astronauts in space today for the first time in more than 40 years. This is after a private launch from NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Houston. The astronauts are due to arrive at the International Space Station tomorrow morning. A lot of national pride is riding alongside the science for this voyage. One of the Indian astronauts said before the flight, "This is the journey of 1.4 billion people."
Utility workers in Lima, Peru, have uncovered a mummy that's approximately 1,000 years old. It was buried less than 2 feet from the surface in a seated position. It still has dark brown hair. Archaeologists say the person would have belonged to a society that fished in the Pacific between 1000 and 1470 AD.
And Jeff Bezos, the multi-billionaire founder of Amazon, was seen waving from a water taxi after arriving in Venice ahead of his weekend wedding. Also today, a mannequin of Bezos was launched on a float in the Grand Canal. It was clinging to an Amazon shipping box with fists full of fake dollars. There's been no comment from Team Bezos about the ongoing protests in Venice.
And those are a few headlines from around the globe we're watching. The NBA Finals wrapped up a few days ago with the Oklahoma City Thunder, the new champs, and Hoops fans have another big thing to look forward to tonight. Players from around the world are angling for their chance to be picked in the NBA draft. The World's Bianca Hillier has this look at some of the top international prospects.
Lenard Solms has been covering Basketball Africa League games for years. It's a professional men's league with 12 teams across the continent. That's where he first saw Kamen Miloic.
He was 15 years old when I first came across him. He was playing for Cobra Sport against Zamalek. And I remember thinking to myself, this kid is not like the others.
To start, Miloic is what's known as a big man, even in basketball. He's 7'2" and 250 pounds.
An incredible shot blocker. He could make some impressive dunks.
What really set Miloic apart, though, is what happened next in his career. He was the youngest player at basketball's 2023 World Cup. Then, in 2024...
South Sudan, their first game in the Olympics, and it ends in victory, 90-79.
Miloic helped his country, South Sudan, make history at the Paris Olympics. This year, he helped Duke University make it to the Final Four during March Madness. All of that as a teenager.
I certainly think that the fact that he's only 18 and he has all of that on his CV already should count in his favor.
That's what Milojic will be banking on, too, as he hopes to hear his name called at tonight's NBA draft. South Sudan has had a few NBA stars in decades past, like Luol Deng, who played in the league for 15 years. Now, Soames expects the young country will rally behind Milojic.
They will take him as a modern South Sudanese hero, especially if he goes all the way and turns into an NBA star.
NBA stars are coming from outside the U.S. more than ever before. Since 2013, more than half of the number one draft picks have been international athletes. That's not expected to happen tonight. Cooper Flagg from Maine is essentially locked in as the first pick. But close behind him could be Vijay Edgecombe from Bimini, Bahamas.
There's a three by Edgecombe, and he buries it. It's hard to say he can do it all, and we see that.
Edgecombe played for Baylor this year in Texas, but says his heart is with the island, and he wants to be in the NBA to help his country grow on such a big stage.
You know, I represent the Bahamas with pride. I know that they support me no matter what.
Another global talent to watch for tonight is Kasparas Jakučionis from Lithuania. He played professionally in Spain before spending the last year at the University of Illinois. But behind the U.S., the most players in this year's draft come from France. Arguably leading the pack is Noah Asenge.
They lead 5-3 as Sarah throws the alley-oop and Noah says, "Watch me fly."
He plays professionally in Germany, where his team is currently competing in the championships, their version of the NBA Finals. Asenge left mid-tournament so he could be in New York at the NBA draft tonight. Yesterday at a press conference, a reporter asked about that choice.
There are people outside that are criticizing you and say you should have stayed with your team until the end. What would you tell them? I mean, you know, that's always an option.
Asenge didn't have a great microphone, but he said he knows draft night is really special, maybe the best day of his life, and he trusts his teammates will do their job. The first round of the NBA draft will be broadcast on ABC and ESPN tonight at 8 Eastern, and the second round is at the same time tomorrow night. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
In Vietnam, data on capital punishment are considered a state secret, so we don't know exactly how many inmates there are on death row. But reportedly, thousands of Vietnamese await execution for a variety of crimes. Some of them got some very good news today. Vietnam's parliament voted to abolish the death penalty for 8 criminal offenses, including embezzlement and espionage. We asked Bill Hayden to explain the decision and its implications. He's with the Asia-Pacific program at Chatham House.
The leadership, the new leadership that's been in charge of Vietnam for the past year, has got a lot of police generals in the Politburo. So you'd have thought that this would be a pretty strong law and order kind of administration, but it seems that it's continuing a process of liberalization. I mean, it's taken 40 years or so, but back in 1985, there were 44 offenses that were included under the death penalty, including things like, you know, selling counterfeit food and things that wouldn't reach a death penalty in other countries. And now it's down to much less than half that.
One very high-profile beneficiary of the change is billionaire property tycoon Trung My Lan. She was sentenced to death in a $12 billion fraud case last year and will now be spared execution because of this law change. Why did her case capture so much attention in Vietnam?
I think it was just the extraordinary sums of money involved. By one count, the total amounts involved, you know, were a measurable percentage of the country's total GDP.
Wow.
It's just a huge case. And, you know, she had become very famous for being flamboyant. And so in many ways, it was a sort of sense that she got her just desserts. I have to say, though, that I haven't actually ever heard of a death sentence for embezzlement actually being carried out.
Okay.
People have received them, but they tended to be used as a means to extract further confessions from the convicted person.
Leverage.
Yeah. So if the authorities felt that, you know, other people were involved in the network, or they hadn't given back all the money, or, you know, they wanted to net, for example, rival politicians in this scandal, the death penalty was used as a tool by investigators to kind of, you know, put a bit of extra pressure on the suspect.
I imagine there will be people whose lives are spared because of this change. Can you tell me anything else about anyone else on death row or the types of folks that will no longer be seeing the death penalty?
Well, it is quite difficult to know very much in detail about the application of the death penalty in Vietnam. We know the numbers of people who are actually sentenced to death, but we know very little about the numbers who are actually executed. And even, you know, some of the most notorious cases, you know, there was a case involving a child rape and murder, and we still don't know for sure, you know, what's happened to the person, who was convicted of that crime and sentenced to death. There are dozens of people, mainly, I guess, sort of low-rank drug smugglers, drug traffickers, who will be spared the death penalty here. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be released. I mean, they may end up still in jail for life.
Right. Life in prison.
Life in prison. Yeah. They are sort of attempting, I think, to sort of show, you know, a more humane side to the Vietnamese justice system, which, you know, is not free and fair. You know, all judges are members of the Communist Party. Trials are often very, very short and perfunctory. I suppose by taking away the death penalty, they are at least reducing the chances of massive miscarriages of justice.
Mm. So with these new changes, how will Vietnam's new death penalty policies compare to, let's say, its neighbors in the region?
I know, for example, that Singapore and Indonesia still have the death penalty among other states. And Singapore does carry out executions, and Indonesia has done, particularly for drug smuggling. So that is sort of one area where emotions are very strong in Southeast Asia. So actually, by taking the death penalty away from use in drug smuggling cases, actually Vietnam is sort of, you know, becoming more liberal than some of its Southeast Asian colleagues.
So 14 countries in Asia do have the death penalty. That includes China, North Korea. Do you think that Vietnam is moving away from the death penalty entirely here?
No, I don't think they're going to move away entirely. I think there's still actually quite a lot of support among public and politicians for its use in certain kinds of cases. But I think what's going on is an effort to reduce it and to try and appear to be more like, quotes, a normal country in the international community.
Bill Hayton is an associate fellow with the Asia-Pacific program at Chatham House.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. It's time to talk about listening. We tend to think of conversation as speech, but listening is just as important as talking. What's that old saying? We have two ears and one mouth for a reason.
In practice, though, listening can go by the wayside, especially when conversations heat up. In a new book, journalist Emily Kazriel delves into what could change if more politicians, pundits, and everyday people at least tried to listen more. Deep Listening, Transform Your Relationships with Family, Friends, and Foes is the title. Kazriel worked in the World's newsroom in its early days and was with the BBC for many years. As she told us, a problem of uncivil discourse is widespread.
In the public sphere, a lot of people feel their role is to convey a vision, to explain the truth in order to convince other people. And indeed, in the private sphere, we feel we need to put the world to right. We need to explain to our kids, to our partners, to our neighbours, to our colleague, what really needs to be done at this stage. Our ears aren't open to listening. And yet, if we're able to take a step back, to act with curiosity, to let the whole of us listen to the whole of them, the person we're listening to has a moment to really unpack what's going on for them, to share something far more authentic, so that at the end of it, they feel heard and we both feel far more connected. Especially important when we have different ideas from the person that we're trying to listen to.
But does that really work in, like, the national, international diplomatic space, where there is so much at stake and people do come with those pre-assumptions?
I think there's two different situations. When you're talking about something which is on public display, it is performative. People are feeling they need to get their point across. But when you're talking about, even in international context, conversations that are happening behind closed doors, it's so important there that leaders truly listen to each other. The research demonstrates that when people are truly heard, they dial down their attitude extremity, which means that they lower the strength within which they hold their own attitude and become more open to considering other ideas. And in fact, I did some research because for the BBC's 100th birthday, I work with a British council and we recruited 1,000 people in 100 countries. And this was a really diverse group of people. Biggest countries represented were Malaysia, UK, New Zealand and Iran. And we found that after people learned how to practice deep listening and then had a conversation about a very contentious subject, which they deeply disagreed, they felt safer to express themselves and genuinely understood. They felt more connected with their conversation partner and this is crucial, they felt more open to re-examine their own attitudes.
So, Emily, as you've considered this idea of deep listening that has led up to this book, I mean, you've turned to some people who've modeled it pretty darn well. You witnessed this early on in South Africa when you were a young journalist. This is before you started actively researching all this. It was during an exchange Nelson Mandela had with opposition leaders. Just describe what happened.
So when I had just arrived in South Africa to be the reporter for BBC Africa, I was in Johannesburg and we heard that a story was unfolding in Pretoria. So we all bundled into the BBC van and turned up because these were soldiers, Mkhonto were Sizwe soldiers, that was part of the ANC's guerrilla army, who'd been integrated into the South African Defence Force, which prior to the end of apartheid was part of the apartheid controlled regime. And these soldiers were angry. They were angry about the food. They were angry about the way they'd been treated by their despised former enemies. They were angry that their rank was lower than that which they had had in the Mkhonto we Sizwe. And so they wanted to speak to their leader, and they turned up at the union buildings, the very heart of the South African establishment, to speak to Nelson Mandela. But he wasn't there. And instead, I found Nelson Mandela walking amongst the soldiers very far from the podium.
Wow, right in the middle of them.
Absolutely. And he was trailed by his bodyguard, but he was walking and talking and greeting them. And he said to one guy, "Hello, what's your name?" And the guy responded, "And tell me, where do you live?" "Yes, I know Alexandra Township, but which street?" "Ah, the corner of that street. Oh, yes, I get it. And now tell me, why are you here?" And only after he spent a whole hour at least wandering amongst the crowd did he get up on the podium and he told these soldiers, "I have heard from you. I understand your grievances. But now you must be disciplined. You must go back to your barracks and you need to help us build the new South Africa." And all the soldiers did what Mandela said.
All right. So let me stop you right there. Extract from that example what deep listening is. Like, what in that moment did you see as Nelson Mandela kind of practicing deep listening?
I think he had a respect for the soldiers, for their humanity and their experience, regardless of what their beliefs were. And he conveyed this through this respect, through really being curious about their story, through seeing them as individuals rather than just a label, which is angry soldiers who were trying to challenge him. And his curiosity also led to empathy, which was evident in his whole manner in which he conveyed to them. And that also led to respect. And the soldiers felt it. They felt respected. They felt heard. And that's why they were then able to listen to what Mandela had to say.
How optimistic are you that divided societies can come together if they just stop to listen to the other side? I mean, again, as a former journalist, you've witnessed a lot of division and war even in your career. Do you really believe there's a way out of this polarization that simple listening can provide?
I don't think that listening is the whole answer, but I think the fact that so many of us want to learn to listen better and want to engage across divides, and when people do have these conversations, as happened when we did that very large-scale global experiment, it was optimistic. People felt excited. People said to me things like, "Thank you so much for giving me permission to listen." Once they understood that listening does not necessarily signal agreement, then all sorts of things become possible.
Journalist Emily Kasriel, her new book published this week is called Deep Listening: Transform Your Relationships with Family, Friends, and Foes.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego.
You can find us online anytime at theworld.org and check out our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life, luminafoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Henry Becton, Richard Gingras, Betsy Gardella and Jim Smith, Rima Heider and Camilo Villa, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.